A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been noticing how often people throw around phrases like late-stage capitalism and post-capitalism, and he's genuinely puzzled by the contradiction. If capitalism shows no signs of actually ending, how can we call this the late stage? It could just be the beginning. He wants to know what people actually mean by these terms, whether they're aspirational rather than descriptive, what a post-capitalist world might even look like, and how much consensus there actually is around the idea that capitalism has passed its sell-by date.
This is the kind of question that sits right at the intersection of economics, political rhetoric, and online culture, and most people use these terms without knowing where they came from. So let's start with the one that drives me slightly crazy, late-stage capitalism. It's everywhere now. You see it on social media, in headlines, in casual conversation. But here's the thing, it's not a diagnosis, it's a vibe.
A vibe with a very specific origin story, though. This isn't just something Twitter invented.
The term actually comes from a German economist named Werner Sombart, who used it in the early 20th century. His book, Der Moderne Kapitalismus, came out in multiple volumes between 1902 and 1927. But the person who really gave it intellectual weight was the Marxist economist Ernest Mandel. He wrote a book in 1972 called, literally, Late Capitalism. And for Mandel, this wasn't a prediction of collapse. It was a historical periodization.
He was describing a phase, not an expiration date.
Mandel argued that capitalism had gone through three stages: market capitalism, monopoly capitalism, and then what he called late capitalism, which was the post-World War II period characterized by multinational corporations, globalized production, and the massive expansion of credit and finance. He thought this was the latest stage, not necessarily the final one. The late was chronological, not terminal.
Which makes the modern usage a kind of linguistic drift on steroids. Because when someone posts a photo of a $12 avocado toast with the caption late-stage capitalism, they're not doing Mendelian periodization.
They are absolutely not. What happened was that the term got picked up by cultural theorists in the 80s and 90s. Frederick Jameson is the big name here. He wrote a book called Postmodernism, or The Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism, in 1991. And Jameson used it to describe the cultural conditions of the era, the flattening of meaning, the dominance of irony, the way everything becomes a commodity, including art and identity. It was a cultural diagnosis, not an economic one.
Then the internet got hold of it and turned it into a meme.
The internet turned it into the catch-all, for this thing I find dystopian about modern life. Annie Laurie wrote a piece in The Atlantic back in 2017 where she described it as a term of art among the left, but noted that it had become essentially a shorthand for the absurdities of consumer culture. The gig economy, the privatization of everything, the feeling that you're always being sold something, it's become a mood.
When someone says late-stage capitalism, they're not making a claim about the system's proximity to collapse. They're naming a sensation, the sensation of living in a world where market logic has colonized everything, including your relationships, your attention, your sense of self.
That's why Daniel's confusion makes total sense. If you take the term literally, it sounds like a prediction. Late stage implies the end is near, but the people using it aren't really predicting anything. They're expressing a kind of exhausted recognition.
It's the difference between this can't go on and I can't believe this is going on. The term masquerades as the first, but it's really the second.
And that masquerade has consequences, because it gives the impression that there's a coherent theory behind it. There isn't. There's a mood, a set of critiques, and a lot of borrowed language from actual Marxist economics, but no unified framework.
Let's pull on that thread. If late-stage capitalism is more cultural critique than economic forecast, what about post-capitalism? Is that more substantive?
It's more substantive in the sense that people have actually tried to sketch what it might look like, but it's also deeply fragmented. There's no single post-capitalist vision. There are at least 4 or 5 competing ones, and they don't agree on much beyond the idea that capitalism as we know it needs to be replaced.
Walk me through the major camps.
Let's start with the one that got the most mainstream attention. Paul Mason, the British journalist, wrote a book in 2015 called Post-Capitalism. His argument, which he also laid out in a widely read Guardian piece that year, was that information technology is fundamentally incompatible with market capitalism. The core idea is that digital goods have zero marginal cost. Once you've produced a piece of software or a song or a design, reproducing it costs essentially nothing. And capitalism, Mason argues, depends on scarcity to set prices. When abundance becomes possible, the price mechanism breaks down.
His argument is that capitalism is being undermined from within by the very technologies it created.
Mason draws heavily on Marxist theory here, the idea that capitalism contains the seeds of its own destruction. But he's not talking about proletarian revolution. He's talking about Wikipedia, open source software, peer-to-peer networks, collaborative production, things that operate outside market logic and produce value without price tags. He thinks these are glimpses of a post-capitalist future that's already emerging.
The Glockenspiel of techno-optimism.
There's a certain amount of that, yes. And the critique is pretty obvious. Information might want to be free, but people still need to eat. The material economy, food, housing, energy, transportation, isn't zero marginal cost. You can't download a sandwich.
Mason's response to that?
He argues for a universal basic income, a shorter working week, and the expansion of non-market production into more areas of life. But the specifics get fuzzy fast. The book is stronger as diagnosis than prescription.
That's one vision. What's another?
The democratic socialist or social democratic vision. This is less about transcending capitalism entirely and more about taming it. Decommodifying essential goods, expanding public ownership, strengthening labor rights, building cooperative enterprises. Think of what Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez advocate. It's post-capitalist only in the sense that it imagines a mixed economy where market logic is no longer the dominant organizing principle for everything.
Which, depending on your definition, is just the Nordic model with extra steps.
Or it's what capitalism looked like in the post-war period in a lot of Western countries, before the neoliberal turn. High marginal tax rates, strong unions, public utilities, regulated finance. The argument from this camp is that capitalism works fine as a wealth-generating engine as long as it's embedded in a strong democratic framework that constrains its worst tendencies.
The counter-argument is that capitalism naturally erodes those constraints over time. That the post-war settlement was a historical anomaly, not a stable equilibrium.
That's exactly the left critique of social democracy. That you can't just build a nice cage for capitalism and expect it to stay there. It will lobby, it will capture regulators, it will find ways to turn public goods into private profits. The history of the last 40 years gives that critique some weight.
What about the degrowth people?
That's camp number 3. The degrowth movement argues that capitalism's fundamental problem isn't inequality or exploitation, it's growth. The system requires constant expansion, and constant expansion on a finite planet is ecologically suicidal. So the post-capitalist vision here is a planned reduction in material throughput. Less production, less consumption, more localism, more leisure, more care work, more reciprocity.
The build me a chair nobody notices they're sitting in. School of Economics.
That's actually not a bad way to put it. The degrowth vision is about making the economy disappear into the background of life, rather than being the foreground obsession. But the political challenges are enormous. You're asking people to accept less stuff voluntarily in a democratic context. That's a hard sell.
Especially when less stuff for people in wealthy countries is one thing, but never get more stuff for people in developing countries is quite another.
That's the equity problem that degrowth advocates struggle with. They're very aware of it. They talk about contraction and convergence, where rich countries shrink their material footprint while poorer countries are allowed to grow until they meet somewhere in the middle. But the political mechanics of making that happen are, let's say, underdeveloped.
What's Camp 4?
Fully automated luxury communism. I'm not making this up.
I know you're not. And I love that this is a real thing people advocate.
It started as a kind of half-ironic slogan, but it's developed into a genuine position. The argument is that automation and artificial intelligence are going to eliminate most human labor, And instead of letting that create mass immiseration while a tiny elite owns all the robots, we should collectively own the means of automated production and distribute the abundance. Hence, fully automated, luxury, communism.
The luxury part, doing a lot of work there.
It's doing tremendous work. The idea is that post-scarcity is technologically achievable. We can produce enough for everyone to live comfortably. And the only thing stopping us is the capitalist requirement that people work for wages to access resources. Break that link, and you get a world where machines do the drudge work and humans do whatever they find meaningful.
It's the most utopian of the visions, and also the one that sounds most like science fiction, which is not necessarily a criticism. A lot of things that sounded like science fiction turned out to be reality. But the gap between technologically possible and politically achievable is doing a lot of unexamined work in that argument.
It's a massive gap, and the fully automated luxury communism crowd tends to be stronger on the fully automated part than on how you actually get from here to there. The transition question is the hardest one for every post-capitalist vision, and it's where the most hand-waving happens.
Are there other camps worth mentioning?
There's the market socialist tradition, which imagines an economy where enterprises are worker-owned cooperatives competing in markets, but with no private ownership of the means of production in the traditional sense. There's the participatory economics model, which tries to replace both markets and central planning with decentralized democratic planning. There's the anarchist tradition of mutual aid and voluntary association. And then there are people who think the nation-state itself is the problem, and post-capitalism requires post-statism.
When someone says post-capitalism, they could mean anything from Nordic social democracy to Star Trek.
And that's part of why these conversations are so frustrating. People use the same words to mean radically different things. It's like saying, I believe in freedom. Okay, but whose freedom from what to do what?
Let's go back to Daniel's question about the Ark. Do these terms, late-stage capitalism and post-capitalism, point to a similar understanding of where capitalism is in its historical trajectory?
They share an intuition, but not an analysis. The shared intuition is that something is deeply wrong. Inequality is extreme, the climate is destabilizing, work feels increasingly precarious, politics feels captured by moneyed interests, and the cultural vibe is one of exhaustion and cynicism. Both terms are responses to that cluster of feelings.
They're diagnostic labels for the same set of symptoms, but they imply different prognoses.
Late-stage capitalism implies that the disease is terminal. The system is in its final phase, whether or not the person using the term has a theory about what comes next. Post-capitalism implies that there's a treatment plan, a vision, however vague, of a successor system, but neither term commands anything close to consensus.
That's worth dwelling on, because there's a way these terms get used that implies a consensus that doesn't exist. You'll hear people say, we all know capitalism is ending, or everyone agrees the current system is broken. But everyone is doing a lot of work there.
Polling on this is complicated, but the broad picture is that dissatisfaction with capitalism is real and growing, especially among younger people, but it doesn't translate into support for a specific alternative. A Harvard survey from a few years back found that a majority of young Americans said they don't support capitalism, but when you ask what they do support, the answers are all over the map. Some want socialism, some want a regulated market economy, some want something they can't quite name.
The vibes are anti-capitalist. The policy preferences are all over the place.
That's a crucial distinction. Vibes are not a political program. You can have a deeply felt sense that the current arrangement is unjust and unsustainable without having a worked-out alternative. Most people are in exactly that position.
Which brings us to the question of whether these terms are aspirational. Is post-capitalism a prediction or a hope?
I think for most people who use it seriously, it's a hope dressed in the language of inevitability. There's a long tradition of this in left politics. Marx himself argued that capitalism would collapse under its own contradictions, that it wasn't just desirable but historically necessary. That gave the project a kind of metaphysical confidence. You're not just fighting for something you want, you're on the right side of history.
That's a powerful rhetorical move. History is on our side. Sounds better than we have a policy proposal we'd like you to consider.
It's much more motivating. But it's also a trap, because if you convince yourself that the system's collapse is inevitable, you don't have to do the hard work of building an alternative. You just have to wait. and waiting has not been a successful political strategy.
It doesn't need ideological commitment. It just needs people to participate in markets. You can despise capitalism and still buy groceries, rent an apartment, take a job. The system reproduces itself through daily practice, not through loyalty.
That's one of the most underappreciated features of capitalism. It's not a belief system. It's an operating system. It runs in the background whether you like it or not. And that makes it much harder to dislodge than systems that depend on ideological buy-in.
If you wanted to overthrow feudalism, you had to convince people that the divine right of kings was nonsense. If you want to overthrow capitalism, you have to convince people to stop buying things. Those are not the same project.
The second one is much harder, because buying things is how most people meet their basic needs. You can't opt out without an alternative in place, and building an alternative while the existing system is still running is like trying to change the engine on a plane mid-flight.
Where does that leave us? If late-stage capitalism is a mood, not a diagnosis, and post-capitalism is a fragmented set of aspirations with no clear path to realization, what are people actually doing when they use these terms?
I think they're doing two things. First, they're signaling a political identity. Saying late-stage capitalism is a way of saying, I see through the system, I'm not fooled by the justifications, I'm on the side of critique. It's a shibboleth. Second, they're trying to name something real that they feel but can't quite articulate. There is a novel quality to contemporary capitalism. The financialization of everything, the platform economy, the way data extraction has become a core business model, the sense that even your interior life is being monetized. People feel this. They know something has changed, and late-stage capitalism is the closest available language.
It's the musical equivalent of naming a chord progression you can hear, but don't have the theory for. You know it's doing something, you know it's not just a standard major scale, but you don't have the vocabulary.
And that's not nothing. Naming a feeling is the first step toward understanding it. The problem is when the naming becomes a substitute for understanding.
Let me ask you something. You're a retired pediatrician. You've watched systems work and fail. You've seen institutions from the inside. Do you think capitalism actually is in some kind of terminal phase?
I don't think we have the evidence to say that. What I think is that we're in a period of profound instability where several long-term trends are converging. You've got climate change imposing real physical constraints on growth. You've got demographic shifts, aging populations in wealthy countries, youth bulges elsewhere. You've got technological disruption that's restructuring labor markets faster than institutions can adapt. You've got geopolitical realignment that's fragmenting the global economic order that prevailed since the 90s. Any one of those would be destabilizing. All of them at once is unprecedented.
None of that necessarily adds up to capitalism as ending. It could just as easily add up to capitalism as entering a much uglier phase.
That's the more likely scenario, honestly. The system has absorbed enormous shocks before. The Great Depression didn't end capitalism. Two world wars didn't end capitalism. The financial crisis of 2008 didn't end capitalism. What changed was the regulatory framework, the distribution of power, the social contract. The underlying logic of accumulation and exchange persisted.
The metaphor of stages might be the problem. It implies a linear progression, a narrative arc. But history doesn't actually work that way. Things don't proceed neatly from early to middle to late. They mutate. They hybridize. They loop back on themselves.
This is why some theorists prefer the term variegated capitalism, or talk about actually existing capitalisms in the plural. The system looks very different in different places and times. The capitalism of mid-century Sweden was not the capitalism of contemporary China, which is not the capitalism of 19th century Manchester. Treating it as a single entity with a single life cycle might be the fundamental category error.
If we were advising someone who wants to think clearly about this, what would we tell them?
I'd say, be suspicious of any term that does too much work. Late-stage capitalism is doing the work of diagnosis, critique, identity signaling, and mood setting all at once. That's too many jobs for one phrase. If you want to talk about inequality, talk about inequality. If you want to talk about financialization, talk about financialization. If you want to talk about the cultural effects of commodification, talk about that. The grand umbrella term obscures more than it reveals.
For post-capitalism?
Ask what specifically is being proposed. Is it worker ownership? Universal basic income? These are all concrete ideas with specific mechanisms and trade-offs. They can be debated on their merits. Post-capitalism as a general aspiration is fine, but it's not a policy.
There's a version of this conversation that happens entirely in the realm of grand historical narratives, and it's almost always unsatisfying. The more productive version starts with what specific thing is broken, and what specific thing would fix it.
That's less exciting, right? We should reform the capital gains tax treatment of carried interest. Doesn't have the same rhetorical punch as capitalism is in its death throes. But one of those sentences describes something that could actually happen next year, and the other describes something that people have been saying for 150 years.
Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto in 1848. They thought the revolution was imminent. It's been 178 years. Capitalism is still here.
To be fair to Marx, he was analyzing a very specific form of capitalism, the industrial capitalism of the 19th century with its 14-hour workdays and child labor and literal starvation wages. That version of capitalism did, in many places, give way to something else. But it didn't give way to communism. It gave way to a regulated market economy with a welfare state. The system adapted.
Which suggests that the most likely future isn't capitalism replaced by something entirely different, but capitalism modified into something we don't have a name for yet.
That's where I'd put my money. The system we have in 50 years will probably be called capitalism, and it will probably be very different from what we have now, and the people who wanted to replace it entirely will say it's still capitalism, and the people who wanted to preserve it will say it's been ruined. That's the pattern.
The one thing I'd add is that there's a genuine question about whether growth can continue indefinitely on a finite planet. That's the degrowth insight, and it's not easily dismissed. If capitalism requires growth, and growth eventually hits biophysical limits, then at some point, something has to give. Whether that something is capitalism or the biosphere is the kind of question that keeps you up at night.
That's where the conversation gets serious, beyond the slogans and the identity signaling. The ecological constraint is real. The climate is changing. Biodiversity is collapsing. These are not vibes. These are measurable physical facts. And any economic system that can't operate within planetary boundaries will eventually be forced to change, one way or another.
The question is whether the change happens through deliberate democratic choice or through catastrophic collapse. And right now, the deliberate democratic choice pathway is not looking great.
No, it's not. But it's also not impossible. The history of environmental policy shows that when the pressure gets high enough, things can move surprisingly fast. The Montreal Protocol, the Clean Air Act, the rapid decline in the cost of renewables. These are examples of collective action working. They're insufficient, but they're not nothing.
To bring this back to Daniel's original questions, what do people mean by these terms? Late-stage capitalism is a mood, a cultural critique, a way of naming the felt absurdity of commodified life. It's not a serious prediction of systemic collapse. Post-capitalism is a family of visions for what comes next, ranging from modest social democracy to full automated luxury communism, with no consensus on specifics and very little work done on the transition problem.
Are they aspirational? They express a desire for something better more than they describe an inevitability. And the art question, do they point to a similar understanding? They share a diagnosis of dysfunction, but diverge completely on the prognosis and the prescription.
The consensus on capitalism having passed its sell-by date is real in certain circles, especially online and in academic left spaces, but it doesn't extend to the broader population, and it definitely doesn't extend to a consensus on what should replace it.
I'd add one more thing. The discourse around these terms tends to be very Western, very wealthy, country-centric. The global middle class, the hundreds of millions of people who've been lifted out of poverty by market, led growth in the last 30 years. They're not sitting around talking about late-stage capitalism. They're trying to get richer.
The perspective from Mumbai or Lagos or Jakarta is often quite different from the perspective from Brooklyn or Berlin.
That should give us some humility about grand pronouncements. When you say capitalism has failed, the immediate question is, failed for whom? It's failed to deliver stable, dignified lives for many people in wealthy countries. It's delivered unprecedented prosperity to many people in developing countries at enormous environmental cost. Both things are true. The system is complex enough that simple verdicts don't work.
Which is, I suppose, the ultimate problem with terms like late-stage capitalism. They're simple verdicts on a complex system, and reality always outruns the slogan. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, Soviet scientists surveying the Emperor Seamount Chain near Kamchatka discovered a single seamount harboring 47 endemic species found nowhere else on Earth. If you stacked those seamounts end to end, each endemic species would represent roughly 210 meters of unique biodiversity per creature, about the height of the Golden Gate Bridge towers per species.
I'm not sure that unit conversion clarified anything.
It clarified that Hilbert thinks in bridge tower units, which is its own kind of endemic phenomenon.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing, and thanks to everyone listening. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.